Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse, and we are talking about a really interesting group today called the Shovel Men. Five guys from Sparta who just got together and decided they wanted to start making their community a better place and helping out. And we're going to find out all the different ways that they've been doing that. There's a book out about them. They've got a website, and they've become quite an ordeal. But it was pretty simple beginnings, just people looking to make a difference in their community. And that's why we wanted to talk to them today on Newsmakers. I'll introduce them all at once here. The Shovel Men are Reinhard Mueller, Jim Cook, Gerald Cast, Al Jenkins, and Kerry Schumann. And I'm pleased to have them here on Newsmakers today. And let me just start right off the bat. We'll jump right in with Reinhard. Tell me about the beginning days of the Shovelmen. Did you envision just a set group like this, or were you just trying to get a project done?
Well, coalesced around various projects that I had done in the community, largely due to the fact that the city administrator now, Todd Fawning, or co-administrator, and I share roots back from the Milwaukee area. We were in the same church together at Whitmore Park Lutheran Church and share the same pastor. He may have been a Sunday school student of mine. He's a little bit younger than me, but we got to be close over some community projects beginning in 05 here in Sparta. And I got to know the guys in the coffee shop and became acquainted with them. And through a project that Jim's wife, you know, very cautiously approached me on in 2006 to renovate a one-room schoolhouse, Jim and I became pretty well acquainted. His wife, Joan, was all about the history and the teaching and the children, and maybe less so about the woodworking, where that's where Jim came in. And I was engaged with everything from foundation work to renovating the structure to putting on a new bell tower. And again, Jim and I got to know each other pretty well. So when the city administrator confronted me with a challenge to build a bridge with some leftover public money on another project for the snowmobile bridge over the interstate, Jim and Jerry and I got to talking about it over coffee. And so when we began executing at it in April, that was really the genesis of this group called the Shovelmen. It then went a couple years before the next one. The city got very excited, wrote a grant for a much larger project, which is where Kerry then came in on the second project. And by the time the third project came around, Al had retired, and we became the five Shovelmen at that point.
That's really interesting. So this Jim, this schoolhouse project that you were working with Reinhard on, did you ever imagine when you were working on that all these years later that you guys would have this identity that you have now in the community?
Not really. It just grew from there, and it's five guys got together, and our ideas just succeeded to the next project and the next project. And we worked in the year around where weather didn't hamper us any. That meant we worked in the winter, we worked in the summer, we worked in the heat, the rain, the snow. And in fact, the one that Reinhard mentioned that we worked on when Kerry came aboard, the day that we poured concrete, we got 6 inches of snow. So, I never envisioned that we would be still together so many years later. And
how in the world do you pour concrete in 6 inches of snow?
Well, it started snowing when we started pouring, and we just worked together and got it done. But we were wet, and Jerry is very conscious of how concrete is done and so forth, and mm-hmm. we used his talents and succeeded to make the pour and got it done. So that's how it goes. We were fortunate that three of us, Al, Jerry, and I, are retired, and Reinhardt and Kerry are still employed. So we kind of work three and two. The three retired guys work together, and the other two work when they're free. And sometimes we help them out, depending on the hours. And that's how it's, we've succeeded in completing all these projects. And I am now 87 years old, going on 88. And I've got to the point where my health and strength is kind of wearing on me. And they still appreciate me showing up on the job. And that I take very seriously.
That's great. Gerald, you were how many projects have you guys done together now?
Boy, most of them. I first met Reinhardt up at the one room schoolhouse. Him and his relative from Germany was working on it, and Jim and I was working on some restorations of the old time outhouses, and I think Reinhardt kind of seen that, and he says, if you could work on an outhouse, you can build a bridge. So,
how many of you do any of you have, you work on construction related projects, sort of, is that anybody's background?
I started out in La Crosse for 15 years in the construction trade. And then I went to the highway department in Monroe County and worked for 24 years.
I'm the same way. I worked for the DOT, and I worked for 38 years for them on road construction, bridges, and so forth. So you can't find, I don't think, five guys that get along. And we all got different opinions, but we all seem to come to a final one and agree, and we have a good time doing it. So, yeah, I think that's one thing that we can really not complain about, but brag about, is we get along so well together.
So, Reinhardt, I'm interested in knowing of. I mean, there's a number of bridges. You're known for working on bridges together. What does it take? Like, what's the nuts and bolts, literally, of building a bridge?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the first one was no small feat in getting it through city council. I don't quite remember why I was motivated to go towards a covered bridge design, other than perhaps its relatively maintenance-free attributes of having a roof over it. But I remember when I was challenged with this in, you know, late February, early March of 2009, my first reaction was to go to the Northeast, New Hampshire, Vermont area, and study these things. And I had a wonderful experience for a weekend in upstate New Hampshire. And I, you know, used the internet to inspire myself on what would be the right bridge for the location and how it would be braced. And I quickly built a model, you know, 1 inch to the foot type scale, and use that to present it to the city fathers. And that was the first of several models I've built to promote projects within the community, but one of four models we built for bridges. It was very effective, and they liked the idea. And I had an opportunity to spend a whole week in Alaska, in an office that I was not terribly tasked, and I busied myself with applying my engineering background and degree in preparing a design for this bridge and doing all the statics work on the truss analysis and so forth and the loading of the bridge, and presented quite a book of calculations to the city. They then began considering this in earnest, and again, received a lot of headwinds as to, you know, just the risk aversion of this in the public sector, in particular by a group of people that aren't necessarily engineers. So we were allowed to proceed, it was built, and everybody smiled, including all the politicians that may not have been so fond of it to begin with. And here we are. It then went to the next bridge where it was a little bit more complicated because it wasn't a flood area of an oxbow of the La Crosse River. And the city hired an engineer to do the hydrology, which is certainly not in my skill set. And the bridge was a manufactured bridge that we put together that came with, professional engineer seal. The dynamic really shifted on this one because the city administrator at the time was really seeing the benefit of these projects. And one of his lieutenants, the director of public works, a former Air Force civil engineer, really wanted to send this thing to committee to die. And he recognized that and looked at the park and rec director, you know, with his bag of softballs and soccer balls behind him and said, "This thing resides in a park, so it falls under your jurisdiction, sir."
Ah, clever.
The rest is kind of history, and the DPW director resigned, and that bridge was as stout as any of them, and the rest is kind of history, as you say.
So these are not like bridges out like on the roads or on the highways. These are are these all like pedestrian bridges, or are they like bicycle paths, or where are these mostly?
Three of the bridges are rated for 25,000 pound loading to support a snowmobile groomer, as that's ultimately how they receive their funding. The one that we built really from hand through examples in the Northeast, again, through another trip, in my opinion, is the stoutest bridge just from how little it deflects. The other bridges are very pedestrian. The Lovelock Bridge is about 6 foot wide and just meant for people. The Shovelman Bridge is on the order of 9 foot wide and is capable probably of holding a vehicle, but again, meant for pedestrians.
Mm-hmm.
And the first bridge, the Beaver Creek Bridge, is about 9 foot wide and meant for pedestrian traffic.
Carrie, do you have a favorite bridge?
My favorite all around would be when I saw pictures of the New Hampshire trip that Reinhard took, come back and says, "Carrie, what do you think? You think we can build something like this?" And I said, "What do you mean build something like this?" And I said, "Yeah, we can probably do that." But Reinhard, with his pictures and his enthusiasm, he just kind of spiked my interest relative to the Mary Morrow Bridge. And I asked him, I said, well, how do we do this? And he goes, "Well, one board at a time."
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so we literally built that thing from scratch. And I think there's, I don't know what a pound level for the steel in the bridges, but very minimal. But the rest of it, it was just a piece of work. All of us on weekends, our evenings, and it was in the cold nonetheless. We were working on that and in the wet, and it was just a neat project because we had to do everything. Nothing was pre-made, and when it came together, it was just. I think it's the most beautiful bridge we've ever put together.
Hmm,
it's all 3x12 planking that was pinned together with 2-inch dowels. So we. Actually, that was part of our fundraisers. You could buy the pin that we put in. The big ones are, what, Riley, they're 2 foot, aren't they? 24 inches or 2 foot? Or,
yeah, the ones for the top and bottom cords are 20 inches long. And the 2-inch dowels that hold the crosses of the lattice together are probably 8 inches long, thereabouts.
Wow.
Yeah. So we had to assemble all this thing and get it lined up, and it's a crisscross, you know, it's all... So it looks like lattice work, and it was a challenge to get it.
It is.
Yeah, and a good thing about that bridge, which is my favorite bridge also, the Mary Morrow, is I'm going to say 97% of the material was gotten within 30 miles of the city of Sparta. And that kind of meant quite a bit, I think, from all of us that it's something put together like handmade, you know. So that's my favorite bridge also.
Well, it's handmade, and it to the extent that, you know, I don't know how much of the material was donated versus purchased, but it also supports local businesses when you buy from them.
One of the unique things relative to that bridge is that we put in a sandstone from a barn wall. And Reinhard, did that stone come from Cashton?
Yes, it did. It came from the Hunt Farm that the house was being raised to make room for a high school extension.
Yeah. And so what's unique about all the stonework is we literally with sandstone, when I was a kid, I was always the carpenter's helper, the mason's helper. And and it was just a unique experience to think that, well, way back when I was 12, 13 years old, I learned something I could put to work today. But we split stone to put on the face of the abutments. And it was a treasure to gain parts and pieces from around the county and put it together, and to see the sandstone on the stone after we got done when we finished it. It is, like I said, the stonework is just absolutely beautiful, and it looks like it was built 100 years ago.
One of your projects is the, I think Reinhard mentioned it earlier, the Lovelock Bridge. And that's that sort of thing is sort of trendy in Europe. I think most people wouldn't consider it something they'd likely to find in Sparta. Tell me where the name for that bridge comes from. Let me ask Jim. I haven't heard from Jim in a minute.
Actually, it came from Reinhard because he is German, and he brought the idea back from Germany about the Lovelocks. We installed cables, like I think they're 1/4-inch cables. There's 3 of them on each side. In the railing part, and it helps for the rules that you have to have what I think is 6 inches between them, so that a child can't fall off and all this and that. So it has 2 reasons. One was that, and the other one was for these Lovelocks. So if there's a couple that wants to cement their relationship, they buy a lock and get their name engraved on it, and they lock it on the bridge and throw the key away. And so that's how the thing goes. I don't know what the number is, but I'm sure there's over 500 on there right now or more. And so it was quite interesting. So it was basically because of Reinhard. He's the one that came up with the idea. So it worked.
That's interesting. So if somebody's interested in these bridges as a project, is can they all be like seen in the same area, or are they on different trails or in different parks, or where do people find them?
Well, the first one that we built is right by the library where we're here tonight, and the Lovelock Bridge is the next one, and the next one to that, you just follow the stream. The next one, there's a path, and actually a sidewalk, and you follow it downstream, and you come to the Mary Morrow Bridge. The next one is the Point Bridge. That's where it dumps into the La Crosse River. The next bridge, which is the Ben Viking Bridge, it's the big one that you see when you come into Sparta. The next one below that is the Shovelman Bridge, and that's the one that's the furthest to, I say, to the south. But the one we're working on now is the furthest one to the east, so on the La Crosse River. So we've got 3 of them that cross the La Crosse River. The rest are on Beaver Creek, which is right in, but they're all within the city limits. So
yeah. And Reinhard, there's one that's being dedicated on the 22nd of August. Is that an event that people can go to?
Yeah, that's the easternmost bridge Jim referred to, located inside the golf course, the River Run Golf Course here, the Sparta Municipal Course. That dedication is at 5:30 on the 22nd of August, and we'll be having a little reception after the dedication back in the clubhouse.
If people are interested in your work, your organization, and finding ways to support it, where can they learn more?
course, our website is theshovelman.org, and that'll direct you to the projects that we're recently involved with, and talks a little bit about our mission statement and what we'd like to see happen. We're getting to a stage in our organizational life that we want to be able to pass the shovel on to the next organization or the next group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And help people break log jams of bureaucracy in their communities to take on these, what some people would think would be projects of a scale that can't happen. And I really need to credit our city administration that, although tongue in cheek, I gave them a hard time at the beginning of this process, they are our biggest supporters. And it's because of the city administration that this works as well as it does.
And there is a book about you, as I understand, perhaps some documentary features in the works, but the book is out. What's that like, knowing that your work has captured the attention of people to the extent that someone would write a book about it?
Well, it's very humbling, and it goes even further than that. We caught the attention of a former intern of mine when I worked at the Air Force Base in Missouri in 95 and through 96. And he followed me here to Sparta, Wisconsin for about a year and a half in a private sector job that I took. And he went on to become a very successful construction company in the Houston, Texas area. And he's responsible for the motivation to create our logo and also funded this book project. He hired a ghostwriter to write this as if we were writing it. We have Jennifer Rodriguez Moran as a photographer, and you know, a formatter that wouldn't be known to anyone here, but that ultimately produced a book that was unveiled on December 16th, and it chronicles six of the bridges and all five of the shovelmen, and also talks about a project in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, where a similar group of men faced very difficult hurdles with city administration on, you know, on a project of a covered bridge that they wanted to build downtown that seemed almost ridiculous to me and the headwinds they faced. But I would think with the size of the metropolis, so go the problems. And we help them through and motivate them through that process to where they were successful in building a bridge. And there's a chapter in that book devoted to those guys.
And your work, not only benefiting Sparta in that case, but helping others, as you said before, helping others to create a roadmap for how they can do things like this in their own communities.
Right. And keeping it sustainable, because these things need to be taken care of. Certainly the publicity that's generated through programs like this one and others helps keep the interest up. And ultimately, you know, we hope that pride in one's community is what really advances through these projects, and the identity that others have with us five ordinary guys that are part of this community, and, you know, that others could picture themselves doing that either in our town or in their own towns away from here.
Well, it's really interesting to be able to shine a light on some of your work, and I think an interesting example. You just never know what five people in a community can do together when they just decide that it needs to be done. We've been talking with the Shovelmen from Sparta today. They are Reinhard Mueller, Jim Cook, Jerry Cast, Al Jenkins, and Kerry Schumann. Guys, thank you very much for being with us here on Newsmakers. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. There is a website where you can find this conversation and all the other shows that we've done. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. Our program continues in just a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. From From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse, and today we're talking about food, my favorite subject ever, and we don't get to talk about it often enough on Newsmakers, but we're talking about it today in a wonderful and interesting context. We're talking about the YouTube program Cooking with Bo. And with us today are the host of that show and the director and producer and videographer of that show as well. First of all, Bo Xiong, thank you very much for joining us again on Newsmakers.
Thank you for having me.
And Dylan Overhouse is with us as well from Dylan Overhouse Productions. Dylan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm really pleased that you've done another season of this show, Bo. We talked to you a couple of years ago when the first season came out. This is now the third season. What gets you all geared up for season three? What are you really excited about people learning this year?
Each year we try to bring something a little bit new and different to the season. This year I decided to incorporate more of the monk farmers, the local monk farmers. So we feature a different farmer per episode, and sometimes we will squeeze in one or two local farmers, just their farm, the produce they grow, who they are, where their farms are located. So it's nice to actually get to know some of the farmers that are at the local markets.
And when you feature them, there's more content this year than at least what I noticed of the first. There's more content of people like using Hmong language to talk about the work that they're doing, and even in some of your cooking demonstrations, you've incorporated that. Was that a specific choice that you decided to do, or did it just kind of come out that way?
I think it was a natural choice. It just kind of happened organically. A lot of the Hmong farmers speak Hmong majority of the time. It was just easier and more natural to go with the Hmong language when you're recording or when you're working with a lot of the Hmong farmers. And some of my hosts, I think two of them, actually speak Hmong predominantly. So it was just a very natural flow cooking with them and speaking in the native language.
Dylan, as sort of on the technical side of a program like this, what does it take to put a show together when you don't have the backing of like some huge television network or something like that?
A little bit extra effort setting up the video shoots. So we had to get there a couple hours early for the shoot days to set up lighting, make sure the audio was right, kind of making sure all the cameras are consistent on your own when you don't have as many assistants to help out with those type of things.
There's a lot of pre-production, a lot of planning ahead of time. It's usually sometimes it takes anywhere from 3 to 4 months of planning of episodes and different shots we're looking at and ingredients. But on the technical side, Dylan Overhouse does a lot of the camera work and a lot of pre-production planning and to like incorporate all the different episodes together. So this year he was mostly the main person to do all of this stuff. Last year there was a few more people. Last year we had like a few more people on the production team. And then the first year we had it was just a very bare bones. It was just like 3 people on the production team doing everything. So this year there's like a smaller production team, but we had like a few small assistants kind of just helping during the production shoots. But a lot of everything that happens behind the scenes and pre-production and post-production, I think Dylan Overhouse kind of have the bulk of it this year.
Well, and you, your small production staff is I think, in keeping with the feel of the show, it's not an intimidating show to watch. Like when you watch it, it feels like regular people cooking the food that they eat anyway and showing you how you can actually do it in your own kitchen, which is one of the things I like about it. Cause like I like to cook, but like I'm not any great master, but all of a sudden now I want to go make pad thai. And I can't wait to see what's coming out as the Thursdays progress and we keep getting more episodes.
I think with the small production team, that kind of lends itself to a more intimate feeling show. And definitely one of our goals when producing the show is to make it accessible for everyday people, and to make some of the specialty crops that they offer at the market, making them a little bit less intimidating to work with for people shopping at the market.
Dylan, are you I know you can handle a camera. Can you handle pots and pans? Are you a cook?
Yeah, quite a bit. I've thought about hopping on and helping out a little bit. It's it's always fun to sit back and watch them because they definitely cook a little bit different than I might.
Do you have a favorite thing that they've cooked on the either this season or in a previous season that you've been involved with?
I think I'd have to go with the pho episode back in, I think that was season one.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
Yep, when we were in Brent's kitchen. I remember that was a really hot kitchen, season, because we didn't have air conditioning.
I think pho seems intimidating to a lot of people, but it's really not. And it's fun, and it's buildable, and you get to put in what you want and what you don't want, and there's like a basic broth. And then everything else is pretty much up to you. It's a very simple dish. I think people just look at it like it's like elaborate, but it's not. Once you kind of know the basic ingredients in it, it's a very fun dish to do.
I've heard when a lot of people talk about it, they talk about, and maybe they're exaggerating to make themselves seem more impressive or whatever, but they talk about just how much goes into making like the authentic broth and everything like that, and how it just cooks for hours and hours and hours. But is like the actual hands-on time a lot less than that, and you're kind of just waiting for it to cook?
Yeah, so okay. It's like making a stew. It's like an old-fashioned stew over the stove instead of putting it in a crock pot.
Okay.
You're just letting it simmer for hours and hours. I know that there are some recipes that it can be simmering for like 2 days, but like anywhere from like 2 to 6 hours, I think makes a good broth.
I have a completely newbie kind of question regarding pho, since that's what we're talking about right now. Whenever I order it at a local establishment, I'm not quite sure if I'm doing it right. So like what are like you get things and some vegetables will be delivered separately from the broth or sometimes the meat might be on the side, or there's all kinds of extra like sauces or seasonings or different things that you can add to it. What's the common way to approach a bowl of pho for the first time?
Okay, so at the restaurants, I think everybody has a different ritual. Like, I know that some people like to put in all their meats and then season it, stir it up, and then throw in their vegetables, because the vegetables can kind of wilt in the hot water. And if you have raw meat, it will cook right away in the hot water. Some people do it backwards, where they, you know, throw in the meat and then they'll just like put in the veggies right away, and then they'll throw in all the sauces. But when I do it at home, like when we make pho at home, I like to, once you put in the broth, the broth is so hot that it will kind of, the noodles will kind of soak up all the broth and get like really big, really fast. And you'll lose all your broth water to the noodles. So once you put in the broth, that happens. So what I normally do is just do the dry noodles, and then I kind of like season it with all the sauces I need. And then I'll put the meat in, I'll do the broth so that it looks really pretty, and then I'll garnish it with all the vegetables. And then like if you want to put something pretty on top just so people can see it, or if you're like a foodie and you want to take your photo, then you could put in like the chili oil or like whatever little garnish you want to on top. And then that'll be, I think, easier to do to keep up with the broth, because it will definitely cook everything in your bowl really fast.
When you go out for pho, I think I've noticed you do the trifecta. So fish sauce, chili oil, and fried garlic is your main go-tos, right?
Yeah, those are the three sauces I like to put in. I don't like to oversauce my broth. So like it's already a good broth. I don't need a lot of ingredients to kind of like all what some of the sauces are just mostly like beef paste extra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have oyster sauce. They have sriracha.
Sriracha is good too.
Yeah, they just have like more things out there to flavor your pho, to, you know, to taste, to whatever you like. But I like to keep it simple. I like the clean broth, so I kind of just do the fish sauce, the lemon, the fried garlic, and then the chili oil.
So people can feel free to do what they want and not be intimidated by it.
Yeah. It's build your own bowl. It's what people prefer. It's
okay.
To your salad.
Well, yeah. Now that was season one. I got way off track here. Season three of Cooking with Bo is what we're talking about right now. What are you excited about cooking this season, Bo?
So, I mean, I learned pad thai from my aunt, who used to run a food truck, and she's an amazing cook. She still does a lot of cooking for some of our family gathering, which is great. So I'm always learning from her. I learned a recipe from my mom, and she's a Hmong farmer, and she just like has all these authentic Hmong recipes. And one of them, she kind of just like kind of whipped together and has continued that recipe for many, many years that I grew up with that I didn't know she made up. But it's kind of like once you know the basics of cooking and what ingredients go well with each other, like you pretty much make up a good recipe or a dish. I made donuts. That was fun.
Donuts was fun.
Donuts was so fun to make. I've never made donuts before, and that was fun and delicious. And then the episode with Abram Kibbe. Kibbe was fun to make too. And I love learning like new dishes and new culture. And that dish was so delicious. And it looks intimidating to make, but it was so fun to do.
That was fun to incorporate a Lebanese dish as well.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I every time I watch an episode, I want to just eat and make food, and it's amazing. But
you please do it, and then yes. And then take a photo of it and give us your feedback.
Oh, yeah,
so we can compare notes.
You don't want my photos. I'm telling you that.
No, okay. Some of the things I love seeing is like when we encourage people to go and shop local for some of these recipes for a show, we like it when they post their version of it or when they went out and actually made it and tried it out and post their thoughts and their own take on it.
Okay. Well, maybe I will. You never know. you said your mother's a Hmong farmer, and you mentioned featuring some of the Hmong farmers on the show, but it's more than just video features. The whole show really was an idea to support Hmong farmers. Tell me how that idea came about.
Yes. So I started the nonprofit right during the pandemic. It was like towards the end of the year. I just saw that the first year of the pandemic was really greatly impacting a lot of the Hmong farmers. I saw how small businesses and small farmers were getting grants and financial assistance, but the Hmong farmers were not, and they were losing their businesses. They weren't able to come to the market, or they were just losing their businesses because we had a smaller crowd coming because of the pandemic. And it was hard to see them struggle even more than they have in the past. So I started the nonprofit to kind of like feature them and help market them. But even though I was doing that, it wasn't actually helping us much. So I decided to fundraise for the Hmong farmers, which kind of sparked this idea of cooking, making a show, and people can watch it. And if they like what they see, they can donate to the Hmong farmers. We can have sponsors that can come on. We can feature sponsors for a donation as well. And there's just a lot of great things that came from it, actually. And we were able to hit our target goal because we let the public know that I think at the time our target goal was $6,500.
Yep.
And that was a small relief fund for per Hmong farmer vendor. But it was helping them. It was helping them stay afloat. It was keeping, you know, some of their business open and or paying for startup seeds. Whatever it is that they needed, it was kind of assisting them. And then I think that show kind of just helped launch this whole campaign to like advocate for Hmong farmers and kind of bring awareness to our community, to the public, that, you know, Hmong farmers are also struggling small business owners. I felt like I started the nonprofit at the beginning to just mostly bring awareness to what was happening. And then there was a great need for financial aid and financial relief funds. So then we started fundraising for them. And I want to say that I have Abram to kind of thank for it, because, and Dylan Overhouse too, because every time I posted like a bowl of food that I made, Abram will comment on it right away, like, I need this recipe, or can you give me the recipe? And then that kind of like snowballs where people would ask for the recipe. And then one day I would just call up Abram and said, hey, do you want my recipe? Because if you do, I would charge you, and the cost is you hosting a show with me. And he's like, yeah, I'm on board. And the idea kind of also came from Dylan Overhouse when he said, why don't you do a cooking show? Could do a cooking show, and we can bring awareness that way to the monk farmers to end their struggles, and so that the public can be entertained and learn something, and also be aware that there is a need in our community to help this, you know, community of monk farmers. So that's kind of how everything came together. And everyone that I asked for, so I went and asked Mike Makes, and I asked La Crosse Local, and everyone just said yes. Mm-hmm. Everyone just said yes right away. We didn't even talk about compensation or anything, because the first year was all like donated time and efforts and talents. So no one actually got compensated the first year, and I felt terrible. But everyone was so willing to help this community of monk farmers get back on their feet or rebuild their businesses.
Well, I know professionals need to, you know, get paid for what they do eventually, but it's nice for people to be involved in a project that they know is doing so much good for people, I think, too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So how many Hmong farmers are part of your organization, Bo?
We do not turn any Hmong farmers away. So I think the first year we had 13 Hmong vendors, and each vendor usually has two people that run the businesses, and okay. Sometimes it's two or three if they have like a third person helping them, like a child from college or just another relative.
Yeah.
But this year we have a little more. This year we're looking at like 15 to 16 vendors, and that's great because we have some returning vendors that lost their businesses during the pandemic. So
and they've been able to start up again.
Yes,
they've been able to start
up again. Yeah, they approached the nonprofit and asked if there's like any financial assistance to restart their business. And that's what we're here for, is to kind of find resources to help them.
That sounds great. So if people are interested in supporting that particular cause, I know this is farmers market season. We're right in the middle of it. Where do these farmers sell their produce?
So La Crosse area has a few locations. We have a location at Cameron Park on Friday evenings. And then Saturday, it's kind of scattered all over. There's like one in Sparta, one in Barakwa, and then one in, is it City Hall?
City Hall in La Crosse.
Yeah, City Hall still has one going on too. And then on Sunday, the big one is in Onalaska Festival Foods, and that's probably the most vibrant one. And you cannot go wrong budget-wise over there. You cannot overspend there unless you're buying everything you see. And then that one, you probably have all the Hmong vendors there from the La Crosse area. Every single one of them will be there. And then I think on, I know La Crosse is like not Wisconsin, but there is one on Tuesday. And then I think Wednesday we might, or is that Tuesday? We might have one at a Shopco. Was it Tuesday or Wednesday?
Maybe Wednesdays.
Yeah, Wednesday mornings. There's one at the old Shopco Center in the north side.
On the north side? Okay. At Bridgeview Plaza, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Parking space. Yeah. I think that's all I can think of at the top of my head, but I know there are more markets in the surrounding area. I just can't think of them right now.
Some of these farmers drive, Viroqua is quite a drive, but some of them drive all the way down to like Iowa, throughout the week to sell as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Just to kind of like spread out their businesses, so we're all not like cluttered in the same spot all the time. A lot of the Hmong farmers do go anywhere from like 45 minutes to an hour and a half or two just to reach another market. Yeah.
Interesting, and it must be really difficult to run a business like that, and especially in this part of the country where the growing season is so short. Do a lot of these farmers have other, I mean, do they have to do other things the rest of the year to supplement that income, or are they actually able to make a go of it farming all the time?
I think that's the difficult part, is that some of these small farmers, they depend 100% on the income for farmers market season. I think like there are some farmers that do work part-time during the year or the winter time. They do have like a part-time job because they're like one of the two partners will have a job. But other than that, more than half of them, this is like their annual income. So in the winter time, they are literally living off of the income they make during the season.
So there have been a few episodes out this year. By the time this airs, I think there'll be four episodes out, five episodes. How many episodes are in this season altogether?
I believe we have only eight this season.
Okay.
The first season was 12, the second was 10, and this season we have eight. I think it's due to time and resource that we kept like shaving down the episodes. Yeah, so but we were lucky we got some pretty amazing hosts to come back this year as well, and some new ones.
Who are some of the guests that are working with you?
So we still have our yearly favorite, Abram Dyke. Oh my God, he's amazing. He's so fun to cook with. He's so funny to watch as well. He just says the most funny things.
The banter between Bo and Abram is always interesting.
And then sometimes it just goes over my head. I don't know what the heck he was talking about because I'm still cooking. I'm in cooking mode. I'm like, on to the next thing. Josh Dumali. So he's from Dirty Dozen Donuts.
Yep.
And he just has these amazing donut recipes. And he's just a fun person to cook with as well.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of local kitchens as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we have, I call her Auntie Mai, but Cooley is actually her name. And she used to be the owner of
MK.
Oh, I'm sorry, MK Concessions, my aunt's business. And I don't know the name, which is a food truck that is still at the farmer's market. And that's where it started as well, with her food truck at the farmer's market, making authentic Hmong dishes and fusion like Thai dishes and pho. And then my mom, we have this oxtail recipe. So that's featured in her episode. And she's just a good person to cook with. I cook with my mom a lot. And nowadays it's mostly me cooking or her cooking, like everything we eat. But growing up, we cooked together a lot. So that was actually a very fun experience again to do for, you know, our audience at home to watch.
So the episodes come out on Thursdays, but they exist all the time online. How do people find them?
So it's easy. You can go to YouTube and you can look up Cooking with Bo LaCrosse, and that will pop up right away. And all the seasons are together. Otherwise, you can go to LaCrosse Local and just Google Cooking with Bo through their search site. And you can also find the episodes listed on their website as well.
Okay. Cooking with Bo, and Bo is B-A-O for,
yes.
For,
yes.
For the uninitiated.
Yeah. Or during the season, we post them on our Facebook, our nonprofit Facebook as well. So if
okay.
They just, yeah, they lurk on our Facebook page to see what we're posting, because we normally will go to the market and kind of just like update people what's at the market this week and what's new, what's coming in the season. And then they will also see the weekly episodes there as well.
Season 3 of Cooking with Bo is out now on YouTube, and Bo Xiong is the producer, the host and creator of that show, and she's the founder of For Independent Hmong Farmers, and also the creator and purveyor of Moth House Press. We didn't get a chance to talk about that today, but Bo is very accomplished in many fields. Dylan is a jack of all trades in media production, videographer, editor, director, producer. Anything else, Dylan? Dylan Overhouse, and he does all of those things on Bo's YouTube program. Dylan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ezra. It's been a pleasure.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. We are here on the campus of UW La Crosse, and if you'd like to get in touch with us throughout the week, you can email me anytime. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. There are two opportunities to hear our show every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network, 90.3. We're on Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And of course, we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers here on Wisconsin Public Radio.